It's the hardest landmine to deal with because, according to author and researcher Mitch Anthony, he says that 50 to 70% of the time, we as advisors do not connect with our clients. That we're so concerned with our own agenda, our own product sale, our own plan, that we don't take the time to get to know what our clients want. So here's a great power question. If you remember nothing else, remember this question. One day, because of death, disability, or retirement, you're going to exit your business. Do you have a business exit strategy? That's been the lead-in over all these 40 years to get into the business market. Here's a little bit better. How specifically do you plan to get the money out of your business in the event of death, disability, or retirement? That's the key question. If they say, no, I don't have an exit plan, then you have all sorts of things that you can talk about. If they say, yes, I do have an exit plan, then that opens up a whole new conversation with a whole new set of questions. And to me, the lack of action in the face of compelling logic has always been a sense of frustration to me until I discovered a simple concept. How do you meld what you want to accomplish with a client into their agenda? And the way that you do that is by asking questions. It's a process which I call guided discovery. And guided discovery is one person led by another to learn from their own experiences. If I tell you something, that's an opinion. If you tell me something, that's fact. So how can I get my opinion to your fact? And it's by asking questions. It's the power of the question. The second landmine is waiting too late to plan. There's a management adage that's been around longer than I can remember, and it says that the day you open your business is the day you start your succession planning. The day you hire a leader is the day you start your succession planning. But the problem is, we all know from our own experience that business owners are so consumed with running their business that they throw every last dollar back into it. You heard the lady this morning talk about her husband, that he was consumed by his business and everything went back into it. And so what happens when they wait too late to plan, they run out of options. Because it takes time to create a succession plan. And the longer they wait, it's like a ship collecting barnacles. Only the landmines that they're collecting are explosive and they can booby trap all the other succession planning things that they're doing. Here's a quote that's over 20 years old. It says, I saw the previous owner of this company get to the point where at age 65, he was desperate. He had done nothing to prepare for his retirement. He had no succession plan. He was vulnerable because of his age, and all his assets were in one place. And I said to myself, I hope that I learned something from this. You see, when a business owner waits too long to plan, they can find themselves with a limited number of planning options due to the fact of short time frames. It takes time to create a successful transition. In many cases, it takes 3 to 5 years. And in the worst scenario, it takes one. So here's just a few questions that a business owner has to look at when they begin to look at their transition plan. First of all, there's only three things that you can do with the business. You can sell it, you can retain it for the family, or you can liquidate it. So if you're going to sell it, who's the buyer? Is it the partners? Is it your key employees? Is it competitors? Is it outsiders? Do you use an ESOP plan? Do you go public? This is two conversations I had the day before I came here. What are you going to do with your business? If you sell the business, is it going to be an asset sale or a stock sale? Are you willing to finance the purchase? And how can you minimize taxes on the transition? These are all questions that you need to be asking to get them thinking about the necessity of planning. if you're going to retain it for the family, you have all the things we just talked about, along with who's the best qualified to manage the company. Can the business support me and them? What do I do for my children that are not active in the business? Sometimes those are paralyzing questions. Which child do I pick to be the successor of my company? And the last one is liquidation. What's the cost of liquidation? What are the economic and tax consequences? These are just a handful of the questions that they need to ask. Now, what about us? How do we come into this particular thing? The one thing that we can do to mitigate the impact of no plan is to get people to begin to develop wealth outside of the business. Because if they have wealth outside of the business, then they have a lot more options. So how do you get them to develop wealth outside the business when we know traditionally they're throwing all of their money back into it? Well, you start where you can. It may be a simple IRA. It may be a 401k plan. It may be an annuity. It may be a cash value life insurance plan that would protect them not only if they die too soon, but would also provide a tax-free retirement. I don't know what it is in Utah, but in Washington, life insurance is exempt from the claims of creditors. So was there Kim? Was that her name this morning that spoke? When she was talking about her husband was being sued, even if he was being sued and she lost everything, she could not lose her life insurance proceeds. The other thing that we look at in landmines is not completing the plan. How many times have you gone in to see a client? And they may have a perfectly written will, a great estate plan, a good buy-sell agreement, a good transition plan, but they never signed it. They never executed it. An attorney I work with told me this story. He said there were two men that got together to develop a perfume factory. And the older man invested the money and the younger man was the nose. And the nose had the ability to take these complex chemicals and combine them and make beautiful fragrances out of them. And so they got a buy-sell agreement and they funded the buy-sell agreement with $1 million worth of life insurance, key person life insurance on the nose. Then they went into a business reversal and the business went south and now these beautiful perfumes became toxic chemicals. And they couldn't just flush them down the toilet. They had to be disposed of. They had to be burned. And it was a whole lot of money to be able to do that. So they were in a catch-22 situation and the nose died in the middle of all this turmoil. The life insurance company paid $1 million on the key man. And the nose's family came to the owner and he said, we want our share, our $500,000. But the nose never signed the buy-sell agreement. And the partner said, I'm not giving you any money. There are all sorts of other landmines that attach themselves to business transition. If we look at the first three, they're really kind of the same. If I have no plan or I waited too late to plan or I never signed the plan, that's basically the same as no plan. But it's the rest of the landmines we're going to discuss that positions you as the trusted advisor. You're going to be able to bring more to your clients than anybody else. And when you do that, you're going to get a steady stream of business and a steady stream of referrals. So, landmine number four is failure to consider the risk. Risk, or the potential for loss, is the standalone landmine. But it attaches itself to all of the other landmines. And I think the impact of risk is often overlooked in the heat of the deal. But it's always there waiting to sabotage the transition. Now, with careful planning, you can mitigate a little bit of the risk, but it's always there. And you see, When you have a buyer and a seller, both are mortgaging their financial future on the continued success of the business. That's another great power question. You're mortgaging your financial success or your financial future on the management ability of the new owner. So, will a company be able to support the expectations of both of them? What happens if there's a business reversal? What happens if the previous owner has to come back in and take over the business? Nobody wants that. If a seller has built wealth outside the business, they have a lot more options. They have a lot more flexibility. But that risk is always there. We had a father that sold a business to his son. It was a very profitable business, and the father negotiated a very liberal package for himself, which was not only a lot of money up front, but also the rest of it in forms of payments and in deferred compensation. Unfortunately, shortly after the sale, the company lost three of its major suppliers, and their net income dropped $100,000 a month. So the father, the seller, was in danger of losing his retirement, and the son was in danger of losing his entire investment. The advantage was that the father had wealth outside of the business and was able to support himself while the son was able to recover. Here's a huge landmine. Is they don't understand the business value. Unfortunately, most business owners buy and sell businesses like you buy and sell a car. They have no concept of how to determine the value of the business. They may have some methodology they use, like a multiple of earnings or a multiple of EBITDA or competent appraisal, but they have no idea what that value is. An M&A advisor, a mergers and acquisition advisor, told me that most business owners leave 30 to 40% of the value of the business on the table when they sell, primarily because they don't understand the value of the business. A friend of mine was a temporary or acting CEO of a sushi company. And the sushi company had a unique process whereby they could keep sushi fresh for months. You could go into the refrigerator, take it out, and it was like it was just made. Plus, they had contracts with Costco and Kroger's and Safeway and a number of other places. But it had been mismanaged by the previous management, and they were drowning in debt, and they had a negative balance sheet. And he called me, and he wanted to sell the business for what he owed in taxes. So I said, well, before you do that, why don't we bring in a business valuation expert and see what it's really worth? The business valuation expert came back and said, it's worth $100 million. And he said, you're joking. How can this business be worth $100 million when I have a negative balance sheet? And he said, it's the value of the intellectual property, and it's the value of the contracts you already have. People would buy this company just to have the ends to the places where you already are. Now, they didn't sell the business for $100 million, but they didn't give it away either. Business owners need to use business valuation experts. In your team of advisors, in your collaborative team of advisors, you need to add your own business valuation expert. We use one all the time. Now, sometimes you'll get a complaint because they don't want to pay the fees for a business valuation. But if experts say that they're going to lose 30 to 40% of the value of the business because they don't understand the valuation process, that's what they're going to pay an evaluator is a whole lot less than what they're going to lose. Yes, sir. The guy that I use is a flat. He's a flat. I'm going to tell you a story in a minute that they had to do extensive valuations, and we had three, and that was pretty expensive, but it was a lot of money at stake on that one. But no, they're reasonable. The other thing that gets in the way of business valuations and understanding the value is ego. business owners have an inflated ego of what the value of the business is. There was an antique dealer in Seattle, and he had a very profitable business. And his son told me the story. He dealt with treasures from around the world. And he was very popular at that time with the rich.com crowd and the interior decorators for these multi-million dollar homes. And so when he started to look for retirement, he wanted to sell the business, and he began to get offers, and they were legitimate offers, but they were below his inflated value of what he thought the business should be. And if you keep saying no enough times, you don't get offers anymore. And then the dot-com bust came, and he lost everything. He lost his business. He lost his retirement. He lost all his time just because of that inflated ego of what he thought the business value should be. Sometimes there's no value in a business because the owners spin it, or else they've sold it to the bank under their line of credit. The current owner may have used the business for their personal bank account, and they spent all of their own cash, and then they spent all the cash that the money made, that the company had, and then they continued to borrow money to support their income. So what happens when a new buyer comes in? The value of the business is only the debt. So if you bought the business, you'd have all the debt and no other business. So what happens is the owner just has to close the doors and walk away. So if you want to sell your business for maximum value, you have to manage it a different way. You have to manage it to get the balance sheet in the right way. And sometimes that takes 3 to 5 years to get it to the point that you can get the value that you want. I had an engineer referred to me by the bank, and he was an acoustics engineer. And he had a talent that gave him a niche market. And he had a national reputation. And when he started the business, he promised this key person 25% of the business. Well, 25% of nothing doesn't sound like a whole lot. But by the time he got ready to retire, 25% of the business was a lot of money. And the way that he was going to do that is he was going to give the employee a stock bonus for 25% of his corporation, until he realized that he had to pay $200,000 in taxes to give him that bonus. And then what happened is we began to realize that he had no money in the corporation, that he was living well beyond his own means, spending everything that he had and everything the corporation had. And he ended up losing the business and going to work for somebody else. Another concept that people don't understand is fair market value versus fair value. So, if you look at a buy-sell agreement, most of them say that the value of the business will be fair market value determined by either a formula or competent appraisal. So what's the difference between fair market value and fair value? You and I own a business. We'll say it's valued at $1 million. And we have a buy-sell agreement, and our buy-sell agreement calls for fair market value. You die. Your spouse comes into me and says, my husband's died. You had a buy-sell agreement. I want my share of the business. And I say to you, yes, we do have a buy-sell agreement. It calls for fair market value evaluation. I plan to honor this, and I'm going to pay you what I owe you. So what happens with fair market value? Fair market value allows for lack of marketability discounts, lack of control discounts, and minority discounts. So let's say that works out to 30%. So now I'm not going to pay you $500,000. I'm going to pay you $350,000 because I applied all the discounts to fair market value. Whereas fair value, what I would have given her the $500,000. So it's important that you work with people that understand not only the difference between fair market value and fair value, but how you apply those in a situation. Here's probably one of the biggest landmines that you come over, is establishing a buyout methodology which is unsustainable. It's a common mistake, and this is where I got a lot of sales for life insurance, is looking at this one thing in a buy-sell agreement. A common mistake is to overlook whether or not the company can support the purchase price and pay the buyer a reasonable living wage. And sometimes there are unrealistic expectations of how this is going to work. I had a client, and the parents owned this very successful business. It came from the mother's side of the family, and she was a very shrewd businesswoman. And she had built this into a multi-million dollar business, and they had four sons. One son was active in the business, and he managed it for them. He made all the decisions. He ran the companies. And the other three sons were not active in the business, and they had a number of personal problems. They had abuse problems or multiple marriages or a number of other things. And so he did not want to be in business with them. So he negotiated to buy the business from his mother. But, you know, sometimes parents try to give him a good deal. Mama wouldn't give him a good deal at all. He paid absolute top dollar for this. And when he did that, there was no room for any downturn in the market. It had to continue making the same amount of money it was making. Unfortunately, the business didn't do that. Shortly after he bought it, it went down. So there was no room, and his desire to get that business at any cost may very well cost him his future. On the lighter side, Mom and Dad got $1 million tax-free for 20 years. Ask her how she felt about how the business thing had worked out. And she said, it's okay if you don't mind living on a fixed income. Many business owners don't consider taxation, the impact of taxation. If I buy a business, I've got to earn the money and pay tax on the earnings before I can buy out and pay the note. That's what happened in the individual with the stock bonus. He didn't have the $200,000 to pay the tax on the bonus. And that's when all of the other things begin to fall apart. So sellers often think of gross numbers, and they don't take into account what they're going to have to pay in taxes. And the end result is they make a deal which they can't change, which is less than they thought it was going to be. At the same time, sellers will make a deal and not realize that they can't make enough money to substantiate the payments and still pay themselves a living wage. The other thing is terms. When you look at a business agreement or buy-sell agreement, usually what you'll find in there is it will say that the note will be 20% down, 20% a year for 5 years at an interest rate, prime interest plus such and such. And there's nothing in there other than a default if you can't make the payments. Well, the owner doesn't want the business back. The previous owner doesn't want the business back. And the seller certainly doesn't want to lose their investment. So what happens if you can't make the payments? Under standard buy-sell agreements, because they're all kind of written by formula, that's what would happen. It would go into default. Now, what if the agreement had a provision in there that said that the note payments could not be greater than 50% of the cash flow? And if they were greater than 50% of the cash flow, there could be some adjustments. The payment may be adjusted down and the note lengthened. The provision also might allow that you could skip payments, but there would be limited things that you could do on that. If you had something like that, the buyer would be protected that he didn't have to take the business back, and the seller's protected that they don't lose their investment. What if I sell you the business, and like my first example, you lose three of your key clients and your business drops $100,000 a month? What happens then? Maybe there's a clause to come back and adjust the valuation of the business. On the other hand, what if I sell you a business and there I've got this deal I've been working on for 5 years and it comes in after I sell the business and you get a windfall profit? Maybe there should be something in the buy-sell agreement that allows for a windfall profit, that I would get a certain portion of that. And again, those terms are kind of limited. The other thing is people don't plan for the unexpected. I had three clients who rushed into buying a business without due diligence on the sale. Two of them were motivated by panic because they had lost their company, they had lost their jobs, and the other one just wasn't paying attention. The first one bought a manufacturing company. And what he found out, what he would have found out if he had done adequate due diligence, is that when it rained, it flooded the manufacturing floor, ruining the equipment and all his inventory. And unfortunately, that happened to him when he was most vulnerable financially, which was in the first 6 months of his ownership. The second was a friend of mine who bought a property and casualty agency. And after he bought the property and casualty agency, and after the money had changed hands and he had signed all the agreements, the key carriers had the ability to disapprove the sale, and they disapproved the sale and drew out. And then he didn't have any employment contracts, and all his employees left and took all of his clients. So he had no carriers, no employees, no clients, but he did retain the debt that he owned to the guy he bought it from. The third individual paid top dollar for the company. Same thing, panic. He came out of being laid off of a job, and he bought this manufacturing company that only dealt with commercial contractors. And what happened when the housing boom went down, his business went down with it. And so if he would have understood how to value the business, he probably overpaid for it. But all of these could have been avoided if they'd had good due diligence. So how do we fit into this process? There are certain things that you can do. Number one, you can ask the right questions. You can ask intuitive questions. You can develop a collaborative team. Do you have a collaborative team of advisors? I have attorneys and CPAs and business valuators and commercial bankers are all part of my team. And so I want to be one of the first three people that my client would call in any situation. I even have a car broker that will go buy them whatever kind of car they want. But you want to put together your collaborative team. Now, the whole thing about a collaborative team is that everybody has to be focused on meeting the goals and the objectives of the clients. And the other criteria is everybody has to play nice. There's no room for ego because we only have one purpose, and that is to take care of the client. Landmine number eight is failure to consider both the transition of ownership and leadership. This is a major landmine that goes undetected all the time. You see, when you sell a business, you have two transitions. You have a new owner, but you also have a new leader. And that's most often manifested by not understanding the culture of the business that you're coming into. All businesses have cultures. Now, if you read the book Good to Great, this happens not only in little companies, but great big companies. How the big companies fail when the new CEO came in and didn't understand the culture of the company. My first job was with Allstate, and then I worked with CNA, and the CEO of CNA, one of the vice presidents from Allstate went to work for CNA as a CEO. Now, Allstate was a very controlled company. You were captive agents. You did what they told you to do. And you had very little options about how you operated. CNA was all independent producers. And he came in there and he tried to run the company like they were Allstate agents. And you don't do very well with independent agents when you do that. But you have to understand the culture of what you're getting into. An attorney told me this question. Let me back up a minute. What I've found is that most business owners are what I call heroic leaders. They make every decision. They know everything about the business. They know every client. Nothing happens that their hand's not on it. And in many cases, the business succeeds by the sheer willpower of that owner. And what happens is they are the ultimate relationship manager. And relationship managers are very difficult to replace. And so when a new owner comes in, he has to earn the respect of the clients of the business, and he has to earn the respect of the key employees. An attorney told me a story about a company, and it had been founded by an ex-military officer. And he said the guy was tough as nails. He ran the business just like he was still in the military. Very strong-willed. And he said that when challenged, often that was settled on the manufacturing room floor by fist. Well, he sold the business. And he sold it to a gentleman that had more of a, more like a professor, more like a teacher, more laid back, more lenient. And what happened shortly after he had bought the business began to fail. And so the new owner had to call in the old owner to come back and tell him what was wrong. Well, what he found was that there was increased absenteeism. There was, the employees were taking too long of breaks for lunch and too long of breaks doing their coffee breaks. And so what happened is the new owner did not have the ability to manage to that existing culture. And so he had to hire back the previous owner at an inflated salary plus what he was paying them to buy the business just to keep from losing his investment. Landmines and family and partner feuds. We could spend the rest of the day and all day tomorrow talking about partner feuds. They dominate the news, the talk shows, even the gossip rags. I've collected articles from all over. I mentioned a little town in Ketchikan, Alaska, and when I had this article, Ketchikan was like 30,000 people. And it was a dispute between a man and his daughter that reverberated through the entire state. And it got so bad that they both had restraining orders against each other. And it was not going to be settled. If you look at family feuds, if you were to go and Google family feuds, you'd get an answer, you'd get like 356 when I did this. If you went on Bing, you'd get 2 million, over 2 million. And they're all over. The partial list is Summer Redstone and his son, Rupert Murdoch and his father, Legal Seafood Brothers, the company split. The Jackson family is fighting over not only his kids, but his money, and now the court's taking the kids away from his mother. It's a never-ending battle. Crippling disputes between partners. We've got two business owners. I've had them as clients for over 10 years. They built a very successful business that pays them in excess of $2 million a year. Unfortunately, as the business prospered, their relationship did not prosper. And it became more and more acrimonious as time went on. The one business owner wanted to sell the business. They said, I think the business has run its course. Let's get out now. Because I think a major player will come in, will take over the market, and we'll lose everything. The other owner said, no. I think we have a unique process. I don't think anybody can knock us out of this. I think the business has a great deal of potential. Besides that, I'm too young to get out of this business. I don't want to start anything else, but I'm too old to get out and start something else. The problem with the owner that wanted out today, they wanted a price based on a strategic buyer, a person that wanted to get into the market, a person that would pay top dollar for the intellectual capital in the property. The other partner wanted what? He wanted to buy it out for bottom dollar. Well, the problem is neither one of them can come to an agreement. It's becoming more and more acrimonious. to sit in that room is you would learn profanity you've never heard before between the two of them. they couldn't agree on value. Now, one of my favorites, incompetent nepotism. I want you to meet my son, Edward. One day this company will belong to him, and I think it's time for all of you to get to know each other. You know, how many times do we see that when we have a child that's not qualified to take over the business? This is where a lot of these transition planning fall apart, because the parents cannot make a decision on who the successor is going to be. The kids don't want to work together. I remember talking to one, and I took the two daughters and I separated them, and I said, what would you do if your dad gave you the business? And as opposed to your sister, and she gave me an answer. And she said, I don't think my sister wants the business. So when I interviewed the sister, the sister said, well, for him to do that would be against his core values. He would never do that. And so you automatically had this conflict set up between the two siblings. But we worked with a family. It was a boat building business. And the father had started in this garage, and he had a unique concept for boats. And he built this boat, and it was very successful, and he made a lot of money. And he had a key employee that had been with him as he began to develop the boat. And what he wanted to do was to take care of the key employee financially and reward him for all the things that he did as the business was built. He also had a son, and he wanted the business to go to his only son. But he wanted the key employee to run the business. And so as we began to talk about this, the father was a very young 60-year-old. He had a passion for fishing. He wanted to start fishing, let the key man run the business, and let the son have the title. The son would have nothing to do with that. Besides that, the son had a substance abuse problem, a really bad substance abuse problem, which the parents refused to admit. They did not recognize it and would not recognize it. And so the son, we tried all sorts of things. Why don't you run this division and learn how to do this, and then you learn this division. He said, no, it's time for Dad to go. It's time for me to own the big bucks. He should be totally out of the company. I should be getting his $1 million a year salary. Well, what they found out is Dad wasn't ready to leave, and the son wasn't ready to lead the company. And so it fell apart. The plan died. Everything was lost, and it's still that way. Here's another one. Not prepared for the wealth. I learned this question from a mergers and acquisition guy. And he said, here's this key question. What are you going to do when you win the lottery? Think about that. I have a client who's negotiating to sell his business for $100 million. That's multiplying his unrealized net worth by 15. He's got 3 children and 5 grandchildren. 2 of the children are well established. 1 is not. Now, above the potential estate tax and income tax problems, do you see any other problems facing up here? What are you going to do when you get all of this money? And the way I like to look at it is I grew up in Texas, and in West Texas, and all over the Southwest, and I'm sure they're here in Utah, you see all these dry stream beds, and there's nothing in it. But you'll see a sign up that says, watch for flash floods. Well, that's like sudden well, because when the spring comes and it starts raining, and it could be raining 100 miles from where you are, but that water's building up and starts coming down through there. And when it comes, there's no place for that water to go, and it just rips everything out. Well, that's the same thing with sudden wealth. People think if I had $1 million, it would be great. If I had 5 million, it would be better. But all you have to look is lottery winners and what happens. Too much money too quick without any preparation is really bad. individuals have to deal with the emotional aspects of sudden wealth. Disbelief, elation, bewilderment. And the outcome's not always positive. They have all sorts of questions. Will the money change who I am? Will it change how I believe? Do I trust myself to remain true to my values? Or will I become a person that I detest? How will my relationship change? Will I have the same friends? Will I feel the same way about them? And how will they feel about me? Now, this is a point that you can be a tremendous asset to those business owners. But when you do that, you have to make sure that you put their interest above your own and you're not motivated by the potential commissions you could make out of managing all that money for them. My CPA told me this about two of his clients. He had a client that owned a very successful business, and they sold it for top dollar. And one of the business owners took his money, went to his old advisor, and put the money there with little forethought, little other thinking. And when the crash came, he lost a great deal of his money, and he lost the ability to live off of the proceeds which he had worked so hard for. Norm, on the other hand, he didn't go just to his current advisor. He went to all sorts of advisors until he found one that he felt had his best interest in mind. And that advisor put together an asset allocation plan that allowed him to weather that storm. So on a side note, Russ Allen Prince did a survey of high net worth individuals, and he said 81% of those surveyed said they planned to take money away from their current advisors. 86% were planning to tell other people to avoid that advisor. And only 2% were going to recommend their advisor. Here's an interesting thing. If you know 8 of the 8 core values of your clients, you will get 100% of all their business, and you'll get an average of 4.1 referrals of similar type people. If you know 5 of the 8 of their core values, you'll get 72% of their business and 1.7 referrals. And if you know 2 of the 8, you'll get 50% of the business and no referrals. So the question is, how do I know what their core values are? You got to ask them. But you have to ask them in a way that they can articulate it, because most people can't articulate their core values. If I were to ask you what your core values are, you'd probably say honesty, ethics, hard work, faith, family. But those may not be your true core values. There is a way to do that. Well, there's all sorts of other landmines. Other landmines. We don't have time to go into any of the others, but I want to leave you with this. The problem with landmines is most advisors are not asking the questions that help getting that business owner to start thinking about their transition plan. If you have the questions, you can motivate them to do something. Now, are you managing your business to prepare for the transition? Are you the indispensable person of your company? You see, business owners, if they're the indispensable person of their company, they've invested all their assets into one stock, and that's them. What's your retirement going to be? We heard today about the longevity risk. And have you covered all your bases? So here's the last thing. Here's a question that nobody is asking. When was the first time all of your advisors got together to understand what your role is for yourself and what you want now and in the future? When was the first time your advisors worked in a collaborative team to create a structure and plan to get your it done? And the answer to that question is never. So with that, I've given you a handout. That's all the written speech. And we have time for any questions that you might have. Yes, sir.
I'd like to know the process you used to uncover those core values.
There's a couple of ways to do that. And you can do this over lunch. You can do this in 5 minutes. And it's one of two questions I ask. One is, I will say, when you were growing up, was there anyone that had a major impact on your life? A teacher, coach, pastor, parent, what? Who was that? And then they'll tell you. And then the next question is, and this is the intuitive question. How specifically did they impact your life? And what was it about them that was specifically important to you? And I let them talk about that. Because here's the thing. The values that they see in other people are the same values they have, because you can't recognize the values if you don't have them yourself. So an intuitive question is one that demands an answer, and it can't be answered yes or no. And the interesting thing about intuitive questions is you'll get a physical response. If you want to try this, when you go home tonight, you go to your spouse or your kids or whatever, and you say, what was the best thing about your day today? And wait for an answer. And sometimes you'll get a flippant answer, but they'll come back and they'll answer it, because the question will stay in their mind until they answer it. And when you ask that question, watch them, because you will get a physical response. They'll pause. They usually look up. And then they answer the question. And that's the value of an intuitive questions. The other question they ask is, describe the house you grew up in. That's always a fun one. And there's a lot of different ways to get into it. And you can get into it without being intrusive. If I hadn't told you this, and even now that I've told you, I could sit down with you out there drinking a Coke and go through this, and you would have a great conversation with me. And I would walk away from there, and you would say, you know what, that's really an interesting guy. And I would walk away knowing what your core values are. Because you see, all their decisions will be based on their core values. A person will not go against their core values when they make a decision. And when you know their core values, then you can say to them in that conversation, to do this is in line with your core values. To not do this is not in line with your core values. You understand what I'm saying? We could talk all day on that. That's a fun subject. Try that when you go home. I'll tell you this. I'm running out of time here. I was telling Mark about it yesterday. I'm on a hospital board, and I was at a function, and they had a CEO there from an insurance company, and he was a very arrogant guy. And I don't remember where he was from, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, something there. And I said to him, I don't remember his first name, but Ken, describe the house you grew up in. And he said, what are you trying to psychoanalyze me? And I said, no, I grew up in a small town in Texas. You grew up in a small town, wherever it was. I'm just wondering what the difference in our childhood was like. With that, he talked for an hour, and I had to walk away from him because I couldn't get him to shut up. But it's the same thing. And then the next question, this builds upon that.